You are tuned to Radio Free Asgard, episode number 52, our first year anniversary on the internet. Hooray! And we have a kind of a different show for you this week, in that we're not going to be doing any comic reviews. Instead, we have a very special guest. So I hope you'll join me in welcoming Mr. Dave Caron to Radio Free Asgard. How are you doing, Dave?
Doing well. Thank you for having me on.
It's a great pleasure. You know, I've been talking about having a Thor worshipper on the show almost since the very beginning.
Well, Thor is so inspiring, it does not surprise me at all that, I mean, having the whole podcast and interest in it, I wholeheartedly endorse it and think it's awesome.
Well, thank you very much. So basically, we've talked a little bit about Asa True on the show before, most notably back in episode number 2, when they had that whole casting kerfuffle over casting an African actor as Heimdall. But can you explain to us just kind of basically what Asa True is?
Asa True is the new reconstruction of the old Norse religion. We're taking the ideals, the principles, the ideas, the inspiration from 800 AD, taking all those gods, goddesses, sagas, all that lore, and bringing that into the modern day. And that's the idea about Asa True.
So when did this start? When did this revival of Asa True actually begin?
It pretty much dates back to the ancient 1970s. There was a lot of interest, and there were a couple of, about a dozen or so folks who got together, who created a national organization called the Asa True Free Assembly. Then that broke apart into a couple different national groups and pretty much snowballed from there.
So how many national groups are there now?
3 or 4, depending on how you count it.
Is there any connection to like traditionalist organizations over in like Iceland or Scandinavia, or is it just strictly an American thing?
It was parallel more than anything else. There was in the 70s, the Icelandic Felag, they started out in the late 70s. But pretty much both the American and the Europeans pretty much have grown up separately. At this point, there are some mixes. In fact, a few years ago, I went over to the International Asa True Summer Camp, which they're having another one this year, actually, in Germany. There is a fair amount of cross-pollinization these days.
What kind of things do you do at an Asa True Summer Camp? Do you throw axes at people?
No, not so much people. They don't make good targets. They keep running and screaming.
Well, that's the challenge.
Now, seriously, it's like any other religious conference. Folks hang out, they drink, they talk, there's classes, there's events, sporting games. Yes, there is some axe throwing, usually against wooden targets. Mm-hmm. The ones that I've gone to, we've done Viking games, lore contests. And generally, it's a great time and a very spiritual one.
It sounds like a good time. So basically, what are the core beliefs of Asa True? Is there like a creed that you can point? I know you like how Christianity would have like the Apostles' Creed or something like that. Is there something like that in Asa True, or is it more casual?
Part of the problem is, as you may have noticed, we're kind of a small religion, and there aren't too many official sources, I should say official modern groups, in terms of there isn't anybody who would dare step forward and say, I speak for everybody, this is exactly what we do. It's just way too much diversity, and we're just not that much of an established tradition yet. That said, I could certainly speak to some degree. I have an officer in the troth. I have been doing this for 10 years, and I can certainly tell you what works for me. And I certainly believe the core beliefs of Asa True being that of steadfastness, of honoring the lore, and it's the lore that really brings forth all the good ideals, the ethics, the morals, and taking those Viking Age concepts and bring them into the modern day. That of, you know, being forthright, being a good person, making the world a better place, and discovering our place within it.
So rather, you don't really have like a big organized religion, as it were. So it's mostly smaller groups that are kind of loosely affiliated with each other? Is that what it is?
The primary vehicle that I believe is the engine of the religion is the kindred. That of, you know, going back, the lore basis is the Jomsvikings. Basically, you have your band, your group, your kindred is the modern term, of a worship group of not just friends, but friends that, you know, are together religiously with the principle of honoring the gods together, worshiping together, and being there for each other. And in that aspect, I would say that it's a communal religion, that it's not just something for individuals, although obviously everybody goes on their path alone, but it's something that we do together in groups. The group that I operate with is Raven Kindred North. We're one of the longest standing kindreds on the East Coast, and we've been doing this for a good long time, and it's been working out so far.
Oh, great. I was doing some reading, as I have been pretty interested in this over the last year that I've been doing the show. And I noticed that there seems to be, at least with some of the groups, an emphasis on genealogy. Is that true of the Troth as well?
The Troth, not as much as the other national organizations. We're big into suggesting that anyone and everyone who has an interest can come and honor the gods and worship with us. There are lots of folks out there who make a very big deal about genealogy, about one's family, and not to suggest it's unimportant. You know, certainly one's loyalty should be to one's family first, but in terms of being a prerequisite, not so much.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that if I were to join the Troth, that I, as a true descendant of Odin, would not automatically be made the leader?
Well, automatically, no. You want to be the leader, you work for it. Our group is actually, we're pretty famous for developing a highly respected and honored tool called the Laugh Test.
Okay.
In that, if somebody steps forward and says, I'm a religious leader, and they're laughed at, not so much. But if, you know, the community does accept a person as being a leader, as being a, you know, we don't have priests, we have gothis, is the correct term for it. And it's not like we have a study course, or, you know, you fill out X piece of paper and you get, you know, Odin sends you the certification in the mail. It's more of a community response, that of, if you've done your homework, if you've done the ranch time and you feel the need to claim that, then, you know, go for it and be recognized by your group. Again, it harkens back to being part of the community. And if you are part of that and do that, then the community can and should respond.
It doesn't sound quite as dramatic as Hugin or Munin bringing you a letter from the Allfather himself. But
unfortunately, I don't know too many people who get those, so...
How would you differentiate Asatru from religions like Wicca, who are sort of emerged in the same time period? They have some of the, you know, commonality in the things that they believe. How different is it from that?
The primary difference is that Wicca has a tradition without a whole lot of dogma. And I would say that the first place that the Asatru needs to go to is the lore, bar none. And admittedly, we only have probably 20-30% of the original text. A lot of that was lost. A lot of that has been done third person, third hand, or many more, years and years after the fact.
So we have another guest on the show.
That would be Gretel. What we do is we as our starting place, go to the lore, go to the dogma, go to the text. And we then branch out from there. Necessarily that it's going to have all the answers, but it's going to have the starting place for the answers. And then we go and branch out and adapt that text from there.
So what would be the primary text that you go to, other than the Eddas themselves?
Primarily the Eddas, but also the sagas, the Heimskringla, all those good texts. And you could actually find most of that for free over the internet.
Well, that's handy.
Yeah.
So now, you mentioned that they have kind of reconstructed this based on what few sources they have. Was there one person who did this, or was this something that kind of sprang up independently in different places?
It was a couple different people, but I mean, it's at this point developed into a pretty well free-for-all. The texts are out there, and there's lots of people who've done translations of stuff, lots of books. The Troth has, a great, the Book of Troth, which is a good starter text to get people going if they're interested in this. But there's, lots of good stuff out there.
So what about the accounts of the historical historians, people like Tacitus and Adam of Bremen? Do you consider them a credible source, or do you kind of view that with some suspicion, coming as they did from the outside, that they weren't part of the communities that they were observing?
Other than the gods themselves, everybody else is suspect.
Okay.
is the correct way to do it. You turn the cover of any and every book, and you will get a product of their time and place. Adam of Bremen was very much a priest. Snorri was a Christian priest. Mm-hmm. And nobody besides... The oldest text we have is Beowulf. And Beowulf, you take a look, and it's, God this and God that. Are they talking about Odin and Thor? Maybe. But it's clearly Christian influenced. Mm-hmm. And that's something that you have to take into account.
Well, what about Tacitus writing in Roman times? Because he was pretty definitively writing about Thor and Woden, as he put it.
And a lot of his text is clearly Roman slanted and done at various points to point out and say, see, these guys have the right way of going about it, and using it as a contrast and a foil to influence the Romans back home. His targets were Romans, not so much, heathens.
Right, and you could argue that basically any historian is writing in and for the time and place that he exists in. So how much credibility would you give to the descriptions of the worship that took place at the temple in Uppsala?
I think that's pretty credible. I think his description, I believe he went on about, Hercules and, right. And used Roman conventions. As I recall off the top of my head, which obviously is, not quite so much. But we can, as a starting point, as a discussion point, yes, we can use that. Mm-hmm.
So what about the depictions of, people hanging themselves to sacrifice themselves to Odin, or the massacre of animals in the temple? How do you adapt something like that to a modern religion?
That's a little more interesting and tricky. Let's be clear, to go a Viking was to go off and, rape, pillage, and slaughter. Most people kind of frown upon that these days. It's one of those, subtle things.
Most people.
Especially, if we're going to raid the English coastline, most Englishmen take very large umbrage at that. Uh-huh. So as a result, we have to, do what's called reconstruction. We have to, take those ideas and bring them into the modern day in an appropriate fashion. We're not just going to go off and, go slaughter people, but we will go and we will, protect ourselves. We will ready ourselves. We will make ourselves strong and be able to defend ourselves. And, when we go off to work, we do so with, one would hope, a gleam in our eyes and weapons nearby in order to fight and do what we need to do.
Hmm. So would you say that it's a militaristic sort of religion or no?
Well, let's be clear. I've always told people that point to the god of war in Ossetru and you're going to need more fingers, because all of them are pretty martial, because we're talking about a religion that was based in a very tough time. In order to get around in 800 AD Iceland, you had to have a weapon handy in order to get by, because it was a very, very dangerous place. And the people weren't no slouches either. It was a very harsh and grueling environment. These days, it's not quite so much, but we keep those ideals and ideas in mind, that we want to fight far away in the world. We want to fight for our families and fight for what's important to us and stick to those ideals. And by doing so, we hope that we will make the world a better place and do well for our folks.
So getting back to the practice of ritual a little bit. How do you get around like sacrificing a bowl or something like that? Do you have like a symbolic thing like a communion, or is it more that they just kind of ignore those parts of the ritual from the ancient times?
I have seen a couple, we call them, the ritual is called the bloat, which literally translated is, blood. The sacrifices that were done back in the day were animal sacrifices, and yes, they killed Bessie. You take a cow and, you know, and you slaughter it, and the idea is you share it with those, with the folks around you and the gods too.
No, not Bessie.
Well, hey, the meat's got to come from somewhere. Mm. You know, these days I'm living up in Maine, and there's farmsteads to, 360 degrees for me. So it's actually a little easier in such an environment, but I admit I'm probably, 1% of the population who can and do that. To be honest, that's certainly not my standard operating procedure in terms of worship. The typical means of bloating, of sacrifice, is, as you say, symbolically. It's you sacrifice via, instead of using blood, you use alcohol. You use mead, you use ale, beer. That certainly makes a whole lot easier an event.
is there a particular brand of beer that goes best with that?
Depends on the occasion.
What about Skull Splitter?
Skull Splitter is a good beer. I'm a beer snob, so.
I'm a beer snob too. I don't drink it because I don't like beer.
Don't know if we can keep talking, but we'll let it slide.
Yeah. I am a Scotch aficionado, and I know what you mean by being a beer snob, because I'm the same way with Scotch. So generally speaking, the rituals, is it one kind of set ritual that you do on a regular basis, or does each god have its own thing, or is it kind of a combination?
What we do is the group, Raven Kindred North, has a set pattern that we use. But the fact of the matter is, I don't think there's a whole lot of wrong ways to honor the gods. I don't think there's a whole lot of wrong ways to get those sentiments out and to honor and worship them. There are wrong ways, I would imagine. However, the sentiment is the core point, and the action accompanying those words. It's deeds and words that we live by. And if both are done with good intent and right action, then it's tough to go wrong in such an environment. The standard ritual, the standard bloat that Raven Kindred does, which we get a lot out of, is basically a combination of two concepts, that of the symbol. The symbol, which goes back to different points in the lore, is the ritual drinking of alcohol. We take a horn full of mead, full of beer, and pass that around. And that's the center of the ritual. There's a couple other steps, but that's the center point of it, where we share of our drink with, and our words over the drink, with those around us and with the gods. And it's a ritual drinking, that of, we take the horn full of the alcohol, we say our words, we say the words that we honor the gods with, to honor the folk with, to honor the ancestors, whatever, and those words we believe spiritually go into that horn, and then that energy gets passed around to all those gathered, and then it goes from the group gathered into a bloat bowl, a vessel that holds in all that good stuff, all those intentions, all those good ideas, all those inspirations. At the end of the ritual, we then take the bloat bowl and libate it, and the words that we use is, from us to the earth to the gods, from the gods to earth to us. A gift for a gift, and libate that drink at the end of the ritual to the gods.
Okay,
that's the core of the ritual. There's a couple other steps in there, but that's the center point of it.
Right. So, do you have specific rituals for specific purposes other than that? So for example, if you're praying to Thor for protection, is there a particular ritual that you would do?
Not really. The bloat is the go to ritual that we use because that's what works for our tradition. I'm happy to go over all the steps if you like. It takes longer in telling than it does to actually do it.
As is so often the case with stuff like this.
Well, you'd be surprised. There's a lot of folks who like the pomp and circumstance, but our tradition is more along the lines of, if your feet are hurting, if you're, there for hours and hours and hours, then you've kind of lost focus.
Right, I understand that. So you don't have like 5 hour long sermons then.
No.
And you have those things that, you know, like they used to use back in colonial America, they hit people on the head with if they fall asleep.
Yeah. There's nothing more spiritually enlivening than passing out, let me tell you.
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, if you take too many libations, then you might do that. Do people like make their own mead and beer for this, or
absolutely.
Just go? Oh, okay. Is that normal, or is that more unusual for people to make their own?
If you taste the results, I think it would be less so.
Uh-huh. Oh, I've made my own hard cider, so I have a little bit of experience with that.
When you make it yourself, it's an amazing thing. Mm. Especially the preferred go-to drink for bloats is mead. And mead in particular is a holy substance when done right. When done wrong, it's, you know, vinegar that at best. When done right, I mean, here's a substance, think about it, that the bees have gone out over the land foraging and grabbing the pollen and all that good stuff from miles and miles around and brought it together to infuse into the honey, you know, which you pour into your water and enliven with some yeast and make some potent and tasty drink.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say, though, I've had a particular type of mead, and this was I've been many times to Finland because my best friend, who is my invisible co-host here on the show, he actually lives there. And at his wedding, I actually sampled some traditional Finnish wedding mead. And I have to say, it was the most vile, nasty stuff I've ever tasted in my life. And it looked like iced tea. In fact, that's kind of what I thought it was.
The thing is that most of the over-the-counter meads can get suck mm-hmm. horribly, awfully. Most of them will even say on the front that it's honey infused wine,
right,
or some drivel like that.
It's like Boone's Farm honey.
it's just awful. Mm-hmm. But if you make the stuff yourself, you can get some amazing results.
Mm-hmm. Well, this wedding mead was not, I don't think it was very alcoholic, but it had little bits floating in it, and it was cloudy, and it just makes me nauseous to think about this stuff. But I happen to like mead, and even the commercial stuff occasionally is pretty good. But I used to belong years and years ago to the Society for Creative Anachronism, which I'm sure you've heard of.
Yep.
So there were a good number of people who were involved in the group back then when I was, who would make their own mead and wine and beer and things and bring them to the events and people would try them. So I'm a big fan of mead, I have to say. So kind of a little shift of topic here. How did you get involved in the Troth?
I got involved in it because at that, it was a long, long journey.
Okay.
Because I for a long time was not terribly interested in national organizations. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that they are very important for helping the movement as a whole. So for that reason, I kind of jumped in. And actually, these days, I'm running for the board, the steering committee. So we'll see how that works.
Right.
Hopefully, by the time this airs, we'll know one way or another.
So are you going to be sending out missionaries to around the U.S. to try to convert people?
Have you heard the word of Odin?
So you're not going to go out and proselytize on the street or in the airport or downtown Chicago and try to convert people to the cause?
No, we are definitely not going to be. You're not going to be hearing our message from door to door.
Well, that's good.
There are some individual groups of Christians who've done that, but I would be aghast and agog if I heard any Ostrard doing as such.
So have the if you're living in a, it sounds like you're living in a reasonably small town or rural area. Are you open in your beliefs there, or is it something that you kind of keep hidden?
Nope, I'm as open as I can be. I go by my name. It's too much part of me for me to hide. Mm-hmm. This is what I am. I mean, it's not something I worship Thor, as when I'm shaking people's hands, but it's, I do have a hammer that I wear around my neck. I do have, it's something that if you ask me, I will be happy to tell you about, mm-hmm. but and I get out there, as much as appropriate for a religious discussion.
Have you had any bad reactions to it or?
No, not in person. You'd be surprised.
Yeah.
Most people. The fact of the matter is, I think the average person is so bereft of spirituality that most people just don't know what to make of it, mm-hmm. for better or for worse. I mean, I have had, you know, people, you know, oh, have you heard the word of Jesus? I'm like, yeah. Have you heard the word of Odin? And people are like, no. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, there's this lore and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, after 3 minutes, you know, their eyes glaze over and they're like looking for the exits.
They scream devil worshiper at you as they leave. My typical response in something like that would be, no, I don't believe in the devil, so why would I worship it? So you, in the past, and maybe to this day, have been doing a podcast. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Ravencast, me and my wife, we started a couple years ago because we saw a bunch of, you know, pagan podcasts out there. We were like, wow, this is a great medium to tell people what we do and tell of you know, other Ostrichar of how we do what we do and get some good information out there. And just to, you know, have people exposed to this stuff. And unfortunately, we're on a slight hiatus since October, where my father passed away and I lost my job. And
oh, sorry to hear.
But thank you. Things are much better now, and I'm hopeful that in May that we're going to get back into full work in order.
Right. And I've gone back and at your advice, so we started talking about, I guess, about a month ago now, and we're talking back and forth, and you suggested that I go back and listen to a few of the shows, and I've done that, and it's a really interesting show. So if anybody out there is interested in hearing more about Asatru and the sort of core beliefs of it, I would definitely recommend checking them out. And what's the address again for those at home?
Ravencast.podbean.com.
Cool. All right. So I remember I listened to your first full episode, which I think was actually the second episode that you did. And you mentioned things like playing D&D and that sort of thing as an introduction to how you heard about the gods to begin with. Do you find that a lot of Asatruar come to Asatru because of that? Or is that something that is just kind of individuals?
I think it's a minority. I think, you know, like something like 20 or 30% maybe are exposed to it through things like that. The fact of the matter is that Asatru is a fringe religion. Mm-hmm. We're not exactly, you know, making the fun of Time magazine. So people hear about these things through all sorts of different and strange ways. So it's for that reason, I think, more than anything else. But if you do a search, you know, for the Norse gods on the internet, you will absolutely find Asatru.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think about things like the Thor comic or the Thor movie? Are those things, do you find those to be in bad taste, or do you generally embrace that as being a way to get people interested in the religion?
I do think it is a inspirational ideal. The thing is that the concept of Thor as a divine being, as a mortal divine being, is very inspiring. And even with a diluted and diffuse message as through Marvel Comics, it is still a powerful message. Even, you know, 3, 4, 6, 10 hands removed, its core ideas still resonate. And so as a result, I'm you know, I have seen, there's certainly plenty of bad Thor stuff out there.
Oh yeah.
But you know, Marvel's early attempts at it are wow.
we make fun of it every week on the show. I think it was kind of ironic to think that, you know, probably the strongest impression that most people have of Thor and Odin and the other gods was actually the result of the work of two New York Jews. but Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, you know, having no knowledge really of the myths other than what they read in Bullfinch's mythology, and coming up with, you know, obviously not a very authentic version of the Norse gods or the Norse way of life.
No question.
Yeah,
I mean, you know.
But I do find it. I find it really interesting. Do you find that people who are in Asatru enjoy that sort of thing, or do they kind of sneer at it?
Honestly, I think that certainly the last Thor movie, there haven't been too many people who have been like, "Wow, that was awful. That was terrible." Most of the folks that I've talked to were, you know, had a really good time with it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I, other than a couple of, you know, knee-jerk idiot, you know, racist D-bags.
Right. Yeah, the people who I've come to call the asshat true. But, because, yeah, we talked about this on Radio Free Asgard number 2, where we had, you know, they cast an African actor to play Heimdall, and it made a big kerfuffle, and it actually made the national media that these people were making a stink about this, because they'd say, well, you know, they shouldn't have a black man playing a Norse god. But, you know, I had a long discussion about this with Paul, who is one of the co-hosts of the show. And, you know, basically our reaction was, you know, fuck the racists. You know, it was a great portrayal of a really interesting character from mythology that most people don't really know anything about.
And more importantly, he did a great job.
I know, seriously. Yeah. And he had the gold teeth and everything, which I thought was just terrific.
Yep.
Yeah, there were a lot of things about the Thor movie that we'd make fun of, but we did enjoy it, and certainly it is kind of interesting, you know, because you think about it as being like, well, what if somebody did a movie starring Jesus as a superhero? Do you think that, you know, Christians would have the same response as the Asatru would have to a Thor movie? And I think we know the answer to that.
Absolutely. I mean, the fact of the matter is that no matter what stripe you paint them in, fanatics will always be fanatic and unreasonable. Right. That's kind of why they're fanatics.
Right, exactly. Do you kind of, are they considered part of Asatru, or is that kind of like a fringe, like the Westboro Baptists?
I would say they're fringe. Mm-hmm. They're certainly no friends of the Troth. We have specific, hard, and vociferous statements to keep them away and up at bay.
In addition to I've read about the Troth online, and I've read about these other groups online as well. It seems to me that the Troth is generally more open to all kinds of people than some of these other groups. And even though they don't say, you know, you can't have any black people in their group, it's almost implied by some of the things that they say, that they want people of Northern European extraction in their kindred.
Well, the fact of the matter is that most of these racists have a agenda, and it's a political agenda. It's not a religious agenda. Mm-hmm. These people don't, you know, aren't going, you know, I want to worship the gods, and therefore I'm going to throw these black people out. It's more like, I want these black people out of here, and oh yeah, the gods too. I mean, it's completely a idea that is only self-serving. They're doing this as another means to provide their message. Mm-hmm. And it's just sad and unfortunate all around.
And I would say the same thing about the fringe elements of any other religion out there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the Ku Klux Klan is obviously a Christian organization, but it's one with that, you know, few Christians would say, well, these people are just, you know, Christian fanatics. No, they're racists. Mm-hmm. They have a political agenda that they're trying to pursue, and they're just doing it using a religious means.
Right. And I would argue, yeah, that most of the people, you've got the Church of Jesus Christ Aryan Nations is another good example of that, of, you know, something that is specifically bills itself as a religious organization, but what they really preach is not their religion in any real sense of the word.
Right.
So, I just curious, what is your background as far as the, you know, the fandom, as far as the Thor comics and all that stuff? Have you been a fan of those, or?
I'll be honest. I collected Excalibur and X-Men.
Uh-huh. There's nothing wrong with that.
I'm still in the Marvel pantheon.
Uh-huh. I've been, you know, it's one of the things, you know, I don't have any religious beliefs anymore. I did back when I was younger. You know, I've always thought of the mythological heroes, you know, people like Thor and Hercules and Jesus, for that matter, as being fictitious characters who, you know, some people have just gotten carried away with. So it's kind of my view on it. But, you know, when we make fun of Thor and Odin unmercifully on the show, because some of the stuff is just too funny to leave it.
And let's be clear, there's lots of points in the lore that the gods are made fun of. And it's, you know, that's okay. If you're not laughing in your religion and not having a good time about it, I think you're probably doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good attitude.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the gods as, you know, the Norse gods are mortal. They are, you know, not some pie in the sky concept, but they know how to have a good time. And I believe they certainly appreciate the humor and appreciate, you know, when things go wrong, to laugh about it.
What did you think of Snorri's assertion that Thor was the Prince of Troy?
Not much.
I didn't think much of that either. It's kind of frustrating. It's interesting.
Well, again, he was playing to his audience. I mean, at the time, I'm sure everybody's kid brother was, you know, part of Troy because that was, you know, the latest thing at that point.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and they had just rediscovered Homer at that point.
Back right.
And you know, how long does it take for Homer to get to Iceland?
Yeah.
I mean, you're kind of out in the middle of nowhere. One of the really interesting things that I found about having traveled in Scandinavia, particularly in Finland, but also in Sweden and Norway, are the vestiges of the religion that still exist, and not in a way that you would see every day in the populace, you know, people, you know, paying tribute to the gods or whatever. But you have a lot of place names, a ton of place names that are named after Thor. But also in some of the rituals that have been syncretized over the centuries, in Finland especially, because Christianity never really caught on in Finland in the same way that it has in the rest of the world. And so they still have their pagan celebrations. They just call it something else.
Right.
And that was
pretty typical over all of Europe. Mm-hmm. What they decided not to kill, they adopted. And adapted. I went to Iceland myself and went to visit a stave church.
Cool.
Which, you know, the stave church is that whole style is completely built on top of the old, you know, Viking hall style. But I went to one of these stave churches and saw a very, you know, large carving of a quote unquote Catholic priest who happened to have a red beard and a hammer.
Well, he had one of those.
Funny that bishop looks a little familiar.
Yeah, he had a one of those foam rubber hammers from Walmart from the Thor movie. No, we have it. We actually have a listener in Iceland, and so I do want to say hello to Robert, who actually lives somewhere near Sleipnir's Hoofprint.
Okay. So,
yeah, there's actually a real place in Iceland where it's a. It's a volcanic feature, obviously, but being Iceland, but it actually is a perfect shape of a horse's hoof. So they refer to that as Sleipnir's hoofprint.
How cool!
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff like that. But I noticed it especially in Finland that there's you still have that as a rule, a physical presence. You still have, you know, the boat tombs, and you still have, you know, the remains here and there of Viking settlements. And that's really interesting. And I don't know if you've ever been to Denmark, but there's a place in Denmark, there's a town, it's near a town called Lejre. It's sort of in the middle, it's kind of due west of Copenhagen, where they have an Iron Age village. And they've done a reconstruction of an Iron Age village, and people live there for about half the year. They don't live there during the winter because they would freeze to death, but that they actually will make things and do things in the way that the Vikings did. And I find it just amazingly fascinating.
There's definitely a couple places that try to do that as well. I certainly saw in Europe the Viking Museum in Germany where they have a real working Viking village and are trying to raise, you know, cattle in, you know, that fashion, trying to get, you know, original genetic lines, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible what they did with what they had back then.
Yeah, given the fragmentary nature of what we know, it's really hard to know exactly. And I think that, you know, when you do something like that, if you try to raise cattle in that way, or you slit your neighbor's throat and throw them in the bog, then you at least have some idea of how what we have found makes more sense, if you know
right.
What I mean. I'm not making any sense, but you know what I mean.
Well, I mean, it was a hard lifestyle. Mm. You know, the average lifespan of somebody back in those days was 30 or 40 years. Mm. I mean, it was not a happy, friendly situation and scenario. Mm-hmm. I'm very glad to live under the rule of law, thank you very much, mm-hmm. and very glad that I don't have to have, you know, a weapon app on me at all times to defend myself, you know, for just such an occasion.
I keep a spear in my house just in case.
I do have some things. I'm much more likely to go to 911 than I am for, you know, any sort of weapon.
Right. Well, I think that's true of most civilized people.
One would hope.
Yeah, exactly. One would hope. You don't need the reputation of being a bloodthirsty Viking, right?
No, I find it really doesn't help me on the job as a lawyer in court. Oh dear.
So you're a lawyer?
I am.
Oh great. So if we need to sue anybody, we'll definitely let you know.
Only good for a couple states in New England.
Oh,
otherwise can't help you so much.
Oh, that's a shame. I guess I'm going to have to not sue people now. Well, I want to thank you very much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun. And I hope sometime you come back and tell us more.
I would be honored. Well, and I do thank you for the opportunity.
And thank you very much, sir. David Karen, folks, from The Troth. And of course, if you're interested in hearing more about Asatru and The Troth in particular, you can go listen to David's podcast over at ravencast.podbean.com. Now, as you heard at the end of the show, Dave has offered to come back at some point. So, of course, if anybody has any questions, feel free to write to the show. Or indeed, if you want to write to the show for any reason, commentary or suggestions or whatever, you can email the show at radiofreeasgard@gmail.com. All right, so it looks like we have enough time for another installment of Just for Valhallavit, the feature where we look at appearances of the Norse gods in pop culture other than comics. And we've got a great one for you this week. Now, think about Thor's enemies for a minute. He's got a lot of enemies that are pretty tough characters, from Ulik to Jormungar, the World Serpent, to Loki, to the Frost Giants. I mean, they're practically endless. But only one character in all of literature was able to reduce Thor into a weepy ruin. Yes, perhaps his most formidable enemy of all. None other than Dr. Zachary Smith. Yes, that Dr. Smith from Lost in Space, Season 2, Episode number 20, the episode entitled The Space Vikings. There's a lot of things that don't make sense about this story. Being lost in space, that's not too surprising. But Dr. Smith comes into the possession of Mjolnir and Yarngripper, Thor's gloves and hammer. Through the machinations of the Valkyrie Brunhilda, Dr. Smith, the robot, and eventually Will are summoned to Asgard, where Dr. Smith is supposed to do battle with Thor. But of course, realizing that he has no chance of winning a physical battle with Thor, Dr. Smith fools him by squeezing water from a stone. Well, a sponge shaped like a stone, anyway. And then managing to convince Thor that without his hammer and his gloves, he is completely helpless. Yes, Thor is portrayed in this as being not very smart, and, of course, possessed of a nasty temper, which, of course, is in line with Norse mythology. But who would know that Thor had childhood issues, considering that he never had a childhood, according to himself in the show? Of course, things eventually are sorted out, and Thor and Brunhilde go off and happily fight the Frost Giants, presumably living happily ever after, while Dr. Smith, the robot, and Will are returned to the alien planet from whence they came. Now, apparently, in the Lost in Space universe, Asgard consists of one cave, which apparently is Valhalla, and an underground chamber, which apparently is Niflheim. I suppose that's all they could really afford to build. There's not a lot of content from mythology in the show, but they do at least mention Odin and Nidhogg, which is the dragon that lives at the foot of the World Tree. And we do at least see Niflheim, though very limited that is. Still, it is lost in space, so really, what do you expect? I suppose one of the few good things I could say about this show is that at least Dr. Smith didn't wander off into a cave and find the gloves and hammer. Instead, they fell out of the sky. This would differentiate it, at least on the surface, from about 90% of the rest of Lost in Space episodes. You would think he would learn to avoid caves after a while, don't you think? But upon reflection, I can't help but think, maybe it's not so far-fetched that Dr. Smith could defeat Thor using psychological means. After all, Dr. Smith is the pinnacle of cunning and guile and greed. You could hardly describe him as a hero, and he's barely a villain. But it does occur to me that perhaps Dr. Smith is the closest thing we have in pop culture to a Loki character. I suppose there's a doctoral dissertation in there somewhere for somebody, though a pretty lame doctoral dissertation if you ask me. But still, if you can defeat Thor, even if it is by untoward means, shouldn't that at least give you some notion of respect among the Norse gods? Who can say? Anyway, that is the show for this week. Thank you very much for listening once again. Thank you once again to David Caron for agreeing to appear on the show, and I hope you all enjoyed it. Next week, we'll be returning back to our normal stuff and covering a couple of Thor issues. Thanks very much for listening. This is Tom in Chicago, Illinois, signing off. We'll see you next week.